Welcome to the Sportscast, June 2020 episode 212. If you haven't yet, please subscribe on all our channels, YouTube, Periscope, and iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. And visit us on thesportscast.net. This episode is brought to you by InstaBible app. You can get the InstaBible app in the iOS App Store. Today we have a special guest. But before we introduce our special guest, we have Justin Riley. Welcome back to the Sportscast.
Hey, glad to be here, Santiago. Blessed to have another opportunity to be on the Sportscast.
Justin Riley, can you introduce our special guest and also a special shout out to a special place in Tuscaloosa?
Man, I would be glad to. Hey, folks, if you're in the Tuscaloosa area, head on over to Ramajamas. There's some fine folks over there. If you're heading in for a game or just want the game day experience, you know, stop on by and then tell them the guys at the Sportscast sent you over. All right, great day. Like Santiago said, very excited to introduce our guest and to have our guest here. He was a two-time Super Bowl winner with the Packers and the Colts, the 1985 ACC Coach of the Year, the 1989 SEC Championship winner, the SEC Coach of the Year in 1987 and 1989. He was the Bobby Dye Coach of the Year in 1989. He's a member of the Georgia Sports Hall of Fame, the winner of the Amos Alonzo Stagg Award, and also he was welcomed into your homes for 10 years as an ESPN analyst on College Game Day. Welcome to the show, Coach Bill Curry.
Thanks, guys. It's great to be on with you.
Coach Bill Curry, you have a lot of rich history in football. Your resume is probably one of the best I've seen in a while when it comes to sports. Can you have like a brief summary of how your career has been so far?
Well, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And at the same time, the most blessed guy in the world. And I used to say, well, God's really blessed me. Well, why, if that's the case, why would he bless me and not bless a bunch of my buddies who didn't get to do all these things? So I think part of it is just being at the right place at the right time. And I think if I were to pick out one aspect of my career that is the most rewarding, it is the diversity, and it's diversity in every way. I've done just about everything there is to do associated with the sport of football. I've been privileged to be on the team with and to play for some of the greatest human beings that ever lived, in my opinion. And they're all different races. They're all different political parties. They're all different countries of origin. I was educated that way. And then the privilege of coaching at locations where some of the great coaches had been, where Coach Bobby Dodd had been at Georgia Tech and Coach Bryant at Alabama, obviously, and Coach Claiborne at Kentucky. And although Georgia State had never had a football team, we got to start that program. I just feel like I've been blessed to be in a lot of places, which afforded me the opportunity to learn from great, great human beings. And some of those human beings are really famous. You would know all their names. And some of them you've never heard of. But they all, the one thing they had in common is that they were unselfish, that they were honest and honorable, and they cared about us, whether we were players or whether we were coaches working under them or working with them. And to be treated that way was a very strong message that, by golly, we better treat our players that way, with honor and caring about each one and trying to teach each one what it meant to be a real man and a real leader. And that's what we tried to do.
Man, that sounds amazing. Coach, I wanted to kind of jump to when you first started out in the NFL. As a player of the Packers, kind of a funny thing. I originally heard in an interview that you said you hadn't realized that you had been drafted by the Packers until your brother-in-law told you. I thought that was pretty funny.
It was really funny. I was so clueless, I didn't know that the NFL had a draft. That's how stupid I was. I didn't. My brother-in-law calls me early in the morning and says, "Hello, Green Bay Packer." I hung up on him because he's always messing with me. So he called me back. He said, boy, you better look in the newspaper. The Green Bay Packers have drafted you. They had 20 rounds in those days.
Right.
The Packers had drafted me. I let you guess which round I was drafted. I was drafted dead last. I was the 20th selection. And sure enough, and I had never gotten a letter from the Green Bay Packers. I had another year of play. I was a 212-pound offensive center, if you can believe it. I mean, you couldn't play safety at that body weight now. But I had the privilege of reporting and being on the team with those great people for 2 years, and then 6 years with the Baltimore Colts, and two more years, one with Houston and one with the Rams in Los Angeles. And so I got a chance to play 10 years, and that was just was a great thing to be in the locker room with so many incredible human beings.
You were in like the first Super Bowl, Coach Bell. How was that? I mean, were you able to know that, wow, this might be the biggest championship throughout history? Like, what were your thoughts going through the first Super Bowl with the Packers?
Well, first of all, we played, I think, 16 league games or 14 that year. I didn't miss a play up until the Super Bowl, but I went out of the Super Bowl with an ankle injury and didn't get to finish the game, and that's always bugged me. But the feeling we had approaching that game was like something out of the Twilight Zone. I mean, it wasn't like any other game. It got all this hoopla, like it was the biggest deal in the history of the world. And then we run out on the field in the Coliseum in Los Angeles. That place seats about 105,000. And there were probably 60,000 people there. It looked like a family day scrimmage. Mamas and daddies spreading picnics. I mean, it didn't feel like a big game. But when we saw the Chiefs run on the field, we realized, uh-oh, this is going to be a big game. They were really a lot better than we thought they'd be. We won the game going away because that was just a great football team. But a few years later, that same Chiefs team came back and hammered the Vikings in Super Bowl IV. They really had great personnel and smart coaches. But anyhow, it was a really weird feeling, and our coach was flipping out. Vince Lombardi, he was getting telegrams from all the NFL owners saying, you better not lose this game. And we didn't know that.
Oh,
we knew
wow.
he was always hard on us, but he put us on a knee in the end zone the day before the game and said, now, man, I want you to understand a couple of things. Now, my contract, remember, my salary was $13,500. He said, if you are late for curfew or if you are late for the team bus or anything, the fine is going to be $2,500. So I was in bed by 7 that night. You can count on that. And most of us were. The other thing he said, if you screw up in this game, you will never play another play in the National Football League. So that's how it felt going into that game. It was really strange.
Pretty powerful stuff. As you mentioned, you only played 2 years there. I mean, after winning the Super Bowl, Green Bay decided your time with them was done. And from what I understand from, you know, watching previous interviews, you were a little upset about that. You know, as a Christian-based company, we're starting to focus on a spiritual message with each of our shows. One of the stories you experienced dealt with forgiveness when it came to Coach Lombardi. It's actually one of my favorite stories. Coach Lombardi was on his deathbed, and you had the opportunity to go visit him. Would you mind telling that story to us?
Well, I really blamed it all on him that I had been put on the expansion list and claimed by the New Orleans Saints, and then they had traded me to the Colts. I was so immature, and that's a kind way of saying I was stupid and dishonest. I mean, it was nobody's fault but mine. And yet I blamed it on him. And when we went to Super Bowl III, which we lost to the Jets, by the way, everybody remembers that one. But I was the only player there that had played for Lombardi and Shula. So the press descended on me and said, well, what's the difference? And I said, well, the difference is, and I said this publicly, Lombardi didn't care about us. He was abusive. Shula's tough as nails, and he drove us harder than Lombardi. But you could tell that he cared about you. And I went on from there and said a bunch of other things, some of which really weren't true. And I'm ashamed of that. So a couple of years later, Paul Hornung and I bumped into each other, and he wanted to fight. He said, that stuff you said about the old man was terrible. And I said, well, what I said was true. At the time, I thought I believed it. I had talked myself into believing it because I was, again, I was sinful. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, if the old man saw you, he'd treat you like his long-lost son. And I said, if he saw me, he'd treat me like dirt, just like he always did. The exchange was just like that. And so when you shoot your mouth off, you need to be real careful, because it wasn't 2 months later, I was walking up a staircase at the president's prayer breakfast in Washington, D.C., and guess who's coming down the other way? And there's no escape. It's Vince Lombardi. Wow. And he greeted me. He greeted me like his long-lost son, which made me feel like about an inch high. This is how God deals with us. Mm-hmm. He said to me, I think, Bill, I think you and I need to talk. And I said, well, yes, sir, we do. And I just couldn't wait to get away from him. I was so embarrassed. So a few months later, he was dying. And at Georgetown Hospital of colon cancer. And one of the many great teammates I had, and I consider this guy one of the greatest because of what he did in this moment. He called me and said, look, I know you're in town in Washington working for the Players Association, and you and I are going to go see Coach Lombardi at the hospital tomorrow. And I said, No, we're not going to see Coach Lombardi, because I wouldn't be allowed in the room. That's one thing. And second, I just can't do that. I was gutless. And he said, well, let me tell you the next thing. I know where your room is. And if I have to come drag your big, you know what, out of there and put you in the car, I'm taking you. You are going with me to see Coach Lombardi tomorrow. Didn't leave me much choice. So we ride up the elevator. The person I was really scared to see was Mrs. Lombardi, Marie, who had always treated Carolyn, my wife, and me just like we were her own. She just had always loved on us. And there she stood, and I got off the elevator, and I didn't know if she would slap me or push me back on the elevator. I didn't know what she would do. Well, she embraced me, and she said, come on, let's go see Coach. She guided me into the room where he was there literally on his deathbed, and he had IVs all in his right arm. So I took his left hand. I'm pretty sure Marie nudged me up close to the bed, because I don't think I would have walked up there, but I can't remember. I was numb. I was so terrified. And I choked out some words like, Coach, I said some things I shouldn't have said, and I'm just so sorry. I came here today to tell you that you've meant a lot to my life. And he didn't waver. Those eyes were the same as they had always been. The body was emaciated. He squeezed my hand. He looked me right in the eye. He said, well, you can mean a lot to my life if you'll pray for me. Well, I promised that I would. And I certainly did. But I also realized as I walked away from that hospital what the great man had done, and that indeed he was not just a man of faith, but in his hour of greatest trial, he lived out our faith as we all should. He forgave me when I least deserved it. And when people do that, they change your life. And that's what Christ meant by treating hateful people with love, treating people who despitefully use you with love and acceptance. And when Vince Lombardi did that, I've never been able to look at other folks quite the same way since then.
One of the greatest coaches of all time. Let's transition to coaching. Bill, you obviously, you know, you've been under the wings of Vince Lombardi and Don Shula, and you became a coach yourself. I've heard you, you know, speak about, you know, the influences, but what were those influences that you brought, and what became Bill Curry the coach? When did that happen?
I went to my college coach, Bobby Dodd, who was just incredible to each of us. He's the reason I graduated from Georgia Tech. When he said, you're going to go to every single class, he was not joking. I thought he was joking. I tried him once, and they ran me till I couldn't stand up, so I decided, well, maybe I will go to all the classes. That's the only reason I graduated. So when I was a senior, I went to him and I said, Coach, I believe I'd like to coach sometime. He said, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, you got a diploma from Georgia Tech. I want you to run an airline or something. You go do something meaningful. Coaching is not a stable profession. But he said, I'll tell you this. If after 10 years you find out you just got to do it, then you come back to see me and I'll help you, because the only way you should coach football is if you have to. And he was right about that. So when I was through playing in the NFL, I learned about myself that I was going to have to coach because I was obsessed with it. And that basically in my heart of hearts, I'm a youth worker and I always have been. And so from the very beginning, I knew that my job was really to help shape young people, especially young men in our sport, but more and more young women are getting involved in the training rooms and in the administrative part. So I've worked with male and female to help realize their full potential as human beings. And then the moment of truth, when I think God really spoke to me and shook me up big time, is the first time I stood in front of 105 teenage males and realized that I was their head coach. Wow.
Wow.
Sense of responsibility. And from that moment until this, that was in 1980, I've tried to remember that that my real role is to help teach young people to be the best human beings they can be and to find their own way in their faith journey, but to make sure that they understand that that's the most important thing they're doing, and that their capacity for relationship is the most important thing. And I've certainly been imperfect, and I've certainly messed up a bunch, but that's what I've tried to do.
Justin, before we go into rapid fire, make sure you have one or two more questions, because the time is kind of winding down. So.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, being an Alabama fan as well as an alumnus of the school, you know, I had to touch briefly on your time at Alabama. You know, you turned around Georgia Tech and things were looking pretty good. Then all of a sudden, Alabama came calling. From what I understand, that kind of shocked you a little bit. It's something you weren't expecting. Why is that?
Well, there was a lot of animosity between Alabama and Georgia Tech that stemmed from an incident way back in the 60s. And that kind of stuff shouldn't be, but it is. And I didn't think much about it at the time, but a lot of people remembered that big time and still remember it to this day. Still, people will still bring it up, and it's shocking to me. But I'm not going to get into details. I'm not going to call anybody's name. So I was stunned when I got a phone call from my old buddy, my old teammate, Ray Perkins. It was New Year's Eve, and he's a no-nonsense guy.
Yeah.
he says, hey, Curry, I want you to take this job. I said, what are you talking about, Perk? What job? He said, this job, Alabama. I've got to go to the NFL. I've got this great contract offer in Tampa. I got to go, and I want you to take it. And I said, you're crazy. I thought about hanging up on him. He said, no, don't hang up. He said, I know you think I'm crazy. I said, I do. I know you're crazy. He said, well, I'm going to hang up here, and in 5 minutes, Dr. Joab Thomas is going to call you. I said, sure. Thanks. Have another drink, Perk. And I hung up. Five minutes later, Dr. Joab Thomas called, and I almost passed out. It was shocking, but it was also an opportunity to do something that was very important, try to take the message to another kind of league in the SEC. I had grown up playing in the SEC. Georgia Tech had gotten out, actually, my senior year, and I'd always regretted that. So I felt like it was almost like a call. I don't know if I made that up or if it was true. I guess I'll never know. But it ended up working out, obviously, at least for a while.
Right. And, you know, you came to Tuscaloosa in a time where, you know, like you said, Ray Perkins was exiting, and the school was still looking for his next, quote-unquote, Bear Bryant to get that title run going again. Of course, we all know the mindset of the Alabama fan base and our expectations, but could you touch a little bit on the mentality of the players themselves and the expectations of those young men you coach?
Gosh, yeah. I tell you this, it is so much fun to coach Alabama guys because you never have to worry about motivating anybody, ever. Because when they show up, they know what the deal is. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, we're going to make sure you go to class. We're going to make sure you graduate. But when we take the practice field or the game field, I'm going to tell you what the mission is, but you already know what it is because you've known about it from the time you were in your cradle. Most of them do. I asked Philip Doyle, the great kicker. Mm-hmm. He signed with us not long after I got there, and I was pretty sure it was because of my personal charm. So I said, I called him in one day. I said, Philip, well, when did you know you were going to come to Alabama? And he said, oh, when I was about 10 years old, I knew. So they don't wonder where they're going to go or why they're there. when they put those jerseys and those helmets on, they run on the field. They got one objective in their mind, and it is to dominate. And it is so much fun to coach them. It was really a joy. And I love my players from all the schools that I coach, but they have a built-in advantage that is just incredible.
Let's jump into the rapid fire, Justin. I'll go with the first one. Question from our Twitter audience, from Robert. Robert. He says, why Kentucky? Why leave gold for the bronze?
Well, being the coach at Alabama is a great thing. But because of circumstances surrounding the job, it was very, very hard for my family. And I felt like at the time that that the best thing I could do for the people that I was most obligated to and the people that I love most in the world was to move on. And Kentucky had a very good situation. It didn't turn out the way we had hoped, but it could have, should have. I just felt like it was better for the Curry family for us to move on. And also, my presence had become a distraction to my players. And one night I went in to do the radio show, and there were three guys sitting there, three of my players. I'm not going to call their names because I don't want to embarrass them. But I said, what are you guys doing? Are you supposed to be in study hall? And they said, we're not going to let you take all those stupid questions on that coach's show tonight, coach. We're going to answer the questions for you. I said, no, you're not. Get out of here. I love you for thinking of it, but you go to study hall. My presence had become a deterrent to our team. And so I just felt like it was the right thing to do was to move on.
I can certainly understand that. I do have to mention this because my mama told me if I didn't do it, she's going to get me when I came to visit her. You actually coached a really good friend of our family, and that was John Mangum. And she wanted me to ask you about, you know, your experience with John and how he was under you and just kind of what your overall experience with him was.
Or tell her I did not coach John Mangum. I just stuck him out there, and he played so well. We didn't have to say a word to John, and John didn't say a word to anybody else. He never said a word. He just showed up every day and played great. John Mangum was a great player and a great guy, and honestly, I don't remember ever having to coach John Mangum. So I don't think he needed us. We needed him a lot. But wow, what a, you can tell your mom that she picked one of the all-time greats. As a coach, you try not to have favorites, and I don't. But if I was going to have favorites, John Mangum would be one of them.
Well, another rapid-fire question from Jeff Goodman. Jeff Goodman, he asks, who do you think could be the successor of Nick Saban?
Who wants to do that? I don't know. I don't. I think nobody wants to do that. I think Nick's probably going to be there. Who was I talking? I was talking to some clever guy, and I can't remember who it was not long ago, and all this stuff came up about Dabo Sweeney. Is Dabo Sweeney going to replace Nick Saban? So we were having dinner or something, and it was just one of my buddies. And I said, well, what do you think? Do you think Dabo would take over for Nick? He said, heck, Nick may take over for Dabo at Clemson, because Nick may coach till he's 90 years old. So I don't have a clue. That's my honest answer. That's going to be a tough job.
All right. Ryan Krista, actually one of our fellow contributors here of the Sportscast, said, you were a player, coach, analyst, author, and founder of the Georgia State football program. Which one of these, I guess, different titles do you have the best memories from, and which of those are you willing to share?
Well, the honest answer to that is when I have dreams about football, it's not about coaching or broadcasting. I loved playing football. I started out as a kid, and I was a short, fat, lazy 12-year-old, and I wanted to quit. And I didn't like football. But by the time I got into my NFL career, I loved every minute of it, and I loved playing. And if I could go out and play one more game, I would in a heartbeat. It would be real ugly, and y'all would have to get an ambulance to get me off the field. But I love playing the most.
Another rapid fire question. Adam Hall, he asks, how long do you feel like the Bear legacy, Bear Bryant's legacy, gave the program validation?
Forever. Coach Bryant was unique. It's not just a reputation. He has a hold on the imagination and on the expectations of that state and that community, really unlike anybody I've ever seen. Maybe Coach Lombardi in Wisconsin matches Coach Bryant, but he was great to me. I never got a chance to tell a lot of stories, but he went out of his way to befriend me. He actually coached me in the Coaches All-America game after my senior year. And I really thought that I probably would not like him. And I mean, I loved him. I loved being his center and playing that one game for him. And his family, when we got to Tuscaloosa, they just swept us into their family. When we go over there now, we still stay with his granddaughter and her husband. So the Bryants mean a lot to us, and I don't think anybody's ever going to be able to really erase that. Now, Saban's done a great job on the football field with the number of championships and that sort of thing, and you can't deny that. But the presence of Coach Bryant, I don't think it's going to ever be matched.
All right. Another question came from our audience, Chris Green. Georgia Tech was your alma mater. It's where you played, and you ended up coming back, and you coached after Bobby Dodd had finished his tenure there. Chris is actually a Georgia Tech fan. He asked if you ever regretted leaving Georgia Tech for Alabama.
Well, when I got that call, first person I called was Coach Dodd. And he shocked me because he had stayed at Georgia Tech and it had many offers to leave. And I said, Coach, are you sitting down? He said, yeah. I said, Alabama has called. He said, you don't mean it. And I said, no, I do mean it. Yeah, they have. He said, are they going to interview you? And I said, yes, sir. They've asked if we could do an interview. He said, and I'll never forget these words. He said, you have to go. You must go. I said, are you, Coach? I can't believe you're saying this to me. He said, look, you got a chance to take the message of winning and the right kind of academics to back to the SEC. And we probably made a mistake getting out of the SEC, but you can go over there and just make a big difference, and you can take the Georgia Tech legacy and do both jobs. You will have done both jobs, and you just got to go. You have to do it. And I said, well, they hadn't offered the job. He said, if they interview you, they will offer it. So with that advice and the advice of some other people that I respected, I felt like it was a must do. But have I ever regretted it? Of course. I regret a lot of the decisions I've made because I know that people were hurt by the decision, and I hate that. And if there was some way to somehow ameliorate that, I would like to, but you can't go back and change things.
Well, we're coming to a close to the show. Tell us a little bit about your book. Ten Men You Meet in the Huddle.
Ten Men You Meet in the Huddle.
Lessons from a Football Life. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, I wrote it about 10 years ago, and then we brought it back out in 2018. It's had reasonable success, but it's really a tribute to all these great people we've been talking about and a bunch more. Just an attempt to say thank you, because I've been surrounded by greatness everywhere I've ever been, and people have taken me in when I least deserved it, and I've never forgotten that. So I try to say thanks to them in the book, and also explain why they were so successful. People like Coach Dodd and Coach Lombardi and great players like Willie Davis and Bart Starr and John Unitas. I just got surrounded by so many great people. I felt like I ought to try to say thanks to them. So that's what that is.
You can check out the book link in the show description. Well, we're in the close. Justin, any closing words to Coach Bill? And then, of course, we'll have Coach Bill say his closing words.
Absolutely. Got a couple of things. First of all, Coach Curry, I just want to thank you for sharing that story earlier about forgiveness and grace, you know, concerning Vince Lombardi. It's a story I feel like, you know, we all need to be reminded of, because so often, you know, we hang on to unforgiveness and it just truly robs from our soul. And, you know, God asks us to forgive others, you know, for, you know, because he forgave us. And it's just a powerful story. And, you know, I come across all walks of life every day where so many people are just being weighed down by unforgiveness, and they just need to hear that message so they can be set free from it. But some of the other things that really stuck out the most about me is not wins, not losses, not titles or whatnot, just how much that you loved your players. And it was amazing hearing it from you. But then also, you know, I did my research and went back and I just listened to your former players and just how much they talked about how much you loved them and how much that you poured life into them. You were a life giver, and you invested in them as people first. And they wanted to play for you. They wanted to win for you. Matter of fact, we had George Teague on a couple of weeks ago, and he said as soon as you came to his house to recruit him, he felt like he was going to run through the wall to tell you, yes, he's come to play for you. And that was just an amazing story. And it's just so refreshing to hear the message of love, because a lot of times that's often lost in this day and age. And that's, I feel like, the most important aspect before that you can bring winning into the equation. So I just want to thank you for that. And and demonstrating God's love to others the way that you do and the way you are called.
Well, that's what coaches can do. And even though, as I've said, it was terribly imperfect, it was the best I could do. And I sure do love all those guys. I still do, and I still hear from them. And it's just one of the great privileges in life to have been with them and to have been a part of their educational process.
You never stop coaching, even though you're retired. It just keeps going.
Nope, never.
Coach, what is the best way for people to reach you online?
The best way to reach me is, I suppose, Twitter, at Coach Bill Curry.
That's the best way. And random question of the day on the Sportscast. What is it, which fast food restaurant makes the best French fries? The options are McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King's, and the
McDonald's.
Five Guys.
Makes the best French fries. My wife and I agree, and it's one of our weaknesses, and I hate to admit it. Hey, y'all, don't ever eat French fries. All you folks out there, they're not good for you. But if you just have to, McDonald's are the best with ketchup on them.
Justin Riley, how about you? What's your answer? McDonald's, Five Guys, Wendy's, or Burger King?
I have to go with Coach Curry on this one. Nothing trumps McDonald's French fries. And
I don't know how they do that.
It's magic, man. That's the only thing I can think of because it can't be replicated. And I hadn't found anyone that comes close.
Well, everyone on Twitter agrees with you. McDonald's 57%, Wendy's at 19.2%, Burger King 3.8%, and Five Guys is tied with Wendy's for second place at 19.2%. So it's quite interesting, the poll on Twitter. Well, guys, Coach Justin, what a show! What an encouragement! This is an impressive resume, and this is definitely, you know, I've always said coaches are one of the best leaders in the world. Like, they, you know, even though it's a football game, but it's almost like war. And they're like our today's generals in some aspects. But, Bill, really appreciate you coming onto the Sportscast.
It's been my pleasure, and it's great talking to you guys. And I hope everything goes well for you. God bless you.